Because we have too much work here, and we have to manage it wisely. I will continue to advocate that, and I will continue to urge the chairman to consider that as a wise approach to the chairmanship of this committee.
So noted. We'll be in recess. Excused from the House session, subject to call, and individual members may have to be excused from the committee if they're carrying bills or have a matter down there that they wish to vote on. However, I'd like to at least try to move through our public hearing this afternoon, scheduled for 3 p.m., and if we can get a quorum together, perhaps we can begin to make some progress on our work session. We're still scheduled for a 5 p.m. subcommittee on the lien law matters in this hearing room. However, whether or not that's going to be able to continue is going to depend in part on the floor session, and also Representative Phillips, who is serving on another subcommittee on PERS and Labor Committee at this time down in room 257. Let's go ahead and proceed with, I understand, Mr. Marquis, you've got a time constraint, have to be up in Portland. If we could go ahead and take House Bill 3075, I believe you're the only witness on that, Mr. Marquis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. House Bill 3075 comes to you, sponsored by Representative Phillips, at the request of the Oregon Collectors Association. It's an amendment to ORS 20.190, the statute outlining what is commonly referred to as prevailing party fees. These are fees which are allowed in the statute as part of costs in a civil action, which generally are allowed in addition to those costs which are delineated in the cost bill to cover those costs in-office expenses in bringing the action. When this statute was last amended, it set out an amount of $35, which would be allowed in an action in circuit court or district court, and when there was no trial. And then further, that half of that amount, or $1,750, would be allowed in a justice court or a county court. The statute remains silent on small claims actions. Small claims actions are brought in a small claims department, as you know, which is a part of a district court. One can make the argument then that since a judgment of a small claims court is a judgment of district court, that one would be entitled to the $35 in a small claims action, but only half that in the justice court, which would be hearing the same type of action. Others would argue that since the statute is silent on small claims, that there would be no prevailing party fee allowed in small claims action. So what we've attempted to do is simply treat a small claims action in the same manner that a justice court action would be treated, and allow the $17.50 in those actions, just like it is in justice court. It's just that simple. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions from Mr. Marquis? Okay, if not, thank you very much. Are there any other witnesses who wish to appear or testify on House Bill 3075? Mr. Marcus?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Michael Marcus, Legal Aid, Portland. My written testimony is three paragraphs long. The comments are really just to bring to your attention the possibility that with respect to non-institutional and occasional or one-time users of small claims court, the adding the stakes may conceivably deter some people from resort to a people's forum, which is designed to dissipate, resolve disputes in the least socially destructive way. I don't think that we want to discourage people from going to court to resolve disputes about which they can't be certain. The other economic reality is that for institutional users of small claims court, generally the cost of collecting bad accounts is already built into the profit and loss structure, both of the retailers or extenders of credit and to the collection agencies themselves. What this would amount to is a shift to a significant, although not astronomical, extent of the burden of economic fluctuations, so when we have bad times, more people will be in debt by more. I just raise those issues because I think they ought to be considered, along with the possibility that the plaintiff ought to be compensated. There already are costs for the filing fees and service fees. Those are routinely awarded. As far as I know, in Multnomah County, having served as a pro tem, I've never seen a case where a prevailing fee was awarded in small claims court.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Marcus? If not, thank you very much. Anyone else on 375? Okay, if not, let's go ahead to the top of our hearing agenda with 3348. And I believe we have Mr. Nass on behalf of the Judicial Department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Nass, legal counsel, Supreme Court Court of Appeals. This bill makes three primary changes. Two of them are highly technical, and I won't go into them unless members have questions for me. The major change the bill would make is to allow the Court of Appeals to permit a defendant in a criminal case to file a late appeal, and by late I mean filing beyond the 30 days from entry of judgment, which is the current statutory period. The defendant would have to show that the failure to file notice of appeal in a timely fashion was not attributable to him. Let me give you some examples of types of situations that we would contemplate the amendment would be used. Defendant is represented at trial by a lawyer who works for an indigent defense contractor that does trial work only. Defendant loses, convicted, judgment is entered. Defendant immediately tells his trial lawyer, I want to appeal. Lawyer says, fine, but I don't handle appellate work. We'll have to file a motion with the trial court and get appellate counsel appointed for you. Either the lawyer doesn't get the motion filed in a timely fashion, or the lawyer does, but the trial court doesn't get counsel appointed in time. 3 days runs, and no notice of appeal is filed. Defendant has done all he could to get his case before the court, and due to the fault of others, it didn't get to the court, and the notice of appeal didn't get to the court on time. That's a situation that has actually happened. Second type of situation is defendant is convicted, says I want to appeal. Appellate counsel is appointed, and the lawyer for some reason fails to file the notice of appeal, either fails to serve it or fails to file it in a timely fashion. Under both of those kinds of situations, the Court of Appeals has a duty to dismiss the case because the failure to file timely is a jurisdictional matter. But likewise, in both kinds of cases, the defendant would be able to file a post-conviction release case and be granted a delayed appeal. Meanwhile, at the post-conviction level, likely the person would be represented by appointed counsel at a cost of $150, $200 or so to the state. The state would have paid for the judge's time. The state would have paid for the defense of the matter. The state puts the bill for the whole thing, and the end result is that the person is granted a delayed appeal anyway. This amendment proposes to cut out the middleman and simply give the Court of Appeals the authority to allow a delayed appeal under the limited circumstance where the failure to file timely is not attributable to the defendant personally. Examples of situations in which the court would not grant relief is defendant is convicted. On the 29th day, he decides, well, maybe he wants to appeal. So he files a motion with the trial court to appoint appellate counsel who would carry the appeal for him. Well, there's no way that the trial court can get counsel appointed and that the lawyer can get the notice of appeal in a timely fashion. In that kind of situation, it's the defendant's own fault that the notice of appeal couldn't get filed in a timely fashion. Another example is that defendant decides to handle his own appeal and simply fails to file the notice in a timely fashion. The intent of the amendment is that such a defendant would not be entitled to relief under this bill. The chief judge, in reading over this bill in its printed form, would prefer to see a small amendment to it, and that's the word "personally" added at line on page 1, line 17, after the first reference to defendant, to insert the word "personally" there to emphasize that the fault that we're talking about is not the fault of a lawyer that might be attributed to the defendant, but clearly the fault of someone other than the defendant personally. And with that, I'll close unless you have any questions.
Okay. I don't know if you have any written comments or written form of that amendment. If so, we'd be glad to receive that and make it part of the record.
I brought over earlier today my written testimony, which I believe should have attached to it the proposed amendment.
Okay, then it's very likely that it's somewhere among the materials that'll be distributed to us and made a part of the record.
Okay.
Thank you. We'll double-check on that. Any further questions for Mr. Nass? Okay, if not...
Can I make one other point?
Sure.
I sent copies of the bill to Judge Barber in Salem, who handles probably 90% of the post-conviction cases, and also to Scott McAllister, who's the assistant AG, who defends most of those, and asked if they had any objections to the bill. Judge Barber said he did not, and in my written testimony, I represented that Scott also did, that I had not had a chance to talk to him. I have since had a chance to talk to him, and he does not have any objection to the bill.
Okay, well, apparently someone from the Department of Justice may have a contrary view, but
I understand.
I guess we'll hear about that a little bit later. And if there are no further questions, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Nass.
You.
Okay, Mr. Pfeiffer? Is Mr. Pfeiffer still with us today? Mr. Bradley, do you want to...
No, I think Mr. Pfeiffer had left. He thought you were going to be in session. I think he told me he was coming back at 4 o'clock.
Okay, we'll be glad to allow him an opportunity to testify at that time, if he can join us then. He is signed up in opposition representing the Department of Justice. Were there any other folks who wish to testify at this time on 3348? Okay, if not, let's move on to our next bill scheduled for hearing, and that is on 3110. And this was introduced by Representatives Calori and Dwyer and Roberts. Mr. Irvine, I believe you're indicated as favoring this. Are you here to speak on their behalf or with their authority?
I know with Representative Calori's authority.
Okay.
And Representative Roberts' authority. I haven't talked to Representative Dwyer.
Okay, that'll be fine.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Jim Irvine here on behalf of the Oregon State Home Builders Association. The purpose of this bill is essentially to allow individuals who are not attorneys attorneys at law to represent property owners before the Board of Equalization on issues where they contest the assessed value of their real property. Two specific instances that we wish to bring your attention to is one, property managers that represent owners non-resident owners that live in other states that wish to have their properties challenge the assessment of their real property. They ask the property managers to take this before the Board of Equalization. They can't. They have to go get an attorney at law to represent them. In most cases, the property managers are real estate licensees by law in Oregon. And they are the ones that truly understand the property and the real values of those properties and can best represent the owner. Second instance I'd like to bring to your attention is family members. A parent who is out of town wishes to be represented by a son or daughter before the Board of Equalization cannot be represented by someone who is maybe very familiar with the property and represent the parent or another family member. So essentially the bill resolves that problem. I have spoken with representatives of the Department of Revenue. I think they're going to be here and testify on this also. And they're going to suggest changing or amending the bill in line 13, I believe, to authorize representative, add the word authorized, with a power or a power of attorney, so that the individual would be at least an attorney in fact, and would have that signed to be able to represent those properties before the Board of Equalization. We would have no objection to that.
Okay. Jim, do you have any idea of the volume of those kinds of appeals in representative jurisdictions? Are we talking about hundreds or thousands?
I doubt that. I think, you know, this is to facilitate individuals that basically think they can do it now, and when they get, they actually sign the appeal and it's sent in and it's rejected at a later date. And we noticed this, we know of several instances that this occurred last May, but I can't say if it's thousands or what it is. I presume it's not very many.
Okay, and is it your sense that people are now appearing in these board of equalization matters without counsel, and this is to legitimize current practice, or?
Well, yes and no. I can speak for my own personal, although I didn't ask this bill to be introduced, but yeah, in Clackamas County this last year, I represented my father, who was out of the country, before the Board of Equalization, and he in fact had signed the appeal himself. The Clackamas County Board would not allow me to appear because my father was not in fact present. I had a power of attorney for my father, but took it to the Board of Equalization, showed it to them, and they would still not let me allow me to testify on his behalf. So, which, you know, was very frustrating to my father and frustrating to me. I think that's maybe a confusion in the law, or at least in the rules, but at least that is being done by one county in particular.
Okay. Are there further questions, Representative Dix? Any further questions? If not, thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Dix?
Curious, Mr. Chair, if the bar has a position on this bill.
I think we may learn.
Mr. Olson from the Oregon State Bar. I would say not specifically on this bill because we're still trying, as you are, assess the scope and how many people are impacted. We have a general conceptual position against this type of non-lawyer representation issue, but do on occasion make exceptions to that if there's a great policy reason for it.
Representative Dix.
You know, there's a tremendous problem right now with assessor's offices in the state over, for instance, reassessing property value. There's a 50% backlog in my county alone for a variety of reasons. There is a significant problem with people, a number of people appearing before my local board in Lane County, for instance. And I know one of their concerns is they have to go out and hire an attorney. And yet board members tell me that really isn't necessary.
I just have a case.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. That's what I say. Yeah. We've indicated to Jim's association that we would prefer a more narrow bill, and we'll be working with them to try to limit the scope to the kinds of issues they're addressing. And so we are willing to go that far.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Olson? Okay, if not, thank you, Bob. We've got Karen Stifler or Stifler.
Sorry if I did a terrible job on that.
Yep, sorry.
Chairperson Springer, members of the committee, my name is Karen Stifler. I'm from the Department of Revenue Assessment and Appraisal Division. And the Department of Revenue is concerned about one part of the bill, and that is on line 13, which ignores the authorization of a representative. We would propose amending the bill to require a power of attorney to authorize a representative. The background, essentially, of this is that during 1980 through 1982, there were many property management firms that were holding general powers of attorney from commercial and retail clients, and during that time they deluged the boards of equalization with petitions. A large percentage of these clients later objected to the filings because they had no prior knowledge. Similar firms were also canvassing residential neighborhoods and offering services where, for a contingency fee based upon the lowering of the value, they would also file petitions to the Board of Equalization. And this resulted in a significant workload impact to Boards of Equalization and also to Department of Revenue Appeals Division. And unauthorized filings are one thing that we feel as an agency should be avoided. The issue of attorney at law was a result of this situation because in some instances people were not represented by true representatives that they have requested, the property owners. And that's the reason why the law now has restrictive language pertaining to attorney at law. And that again refers to who may sign the petition. It does not refer to who may represent the petitioner at a Board of Equalization hearing. The 1983 legislature reacted to these abuses and added the language, be verified by the oath of the petitioner or attorney at law for the petitioner. That's a little background on why the attorney at law language now exists in the law. If I could read from the Board of Equalization manual that's published by the Department of Revenue, it says, while petitions must be signed by the property owner or person in whose name the property is assessed, petitioners may present their own case or they may authorize another person to present it. Many times petitioners bring an appraiser, real estate broker, accountant, bookkeeper, or attorney to present at least part of the case. Again, that needs to be an authorized representative, but it is not necessary to have an attorney at law at the Board of Equalization proceedings.
Hmm. Any questions? I don't know if you had written comments or if your amendments are prepared in writing, but that would be helpful to us when we get to work session on this matter. Any questions? Okay, if not, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. Anyone else on 3110? Okay. I guess we're still awaiting Mr. Pfeiffer comes back on one of the other bills. We'll be glad to hear him at that time, but let's see if we can't make some progress in work session on the bills that we've got scheduled so far.
If you need me.
Okay. Let's try 2949. This is Representative Schoon's bill. There were some further amendments requested in order to make this neutral in terms of its fiscal impact. It's undergone some significant changes in terms of who's responsible for the staffing duties. And this has been worked out with the Legislative Council, Mr. Clifford, and I believe he has prepared the final set of amendments which appear before us, and Representative Schoon has indicated his support for these amendments, if I'm correct, and as I understand it, the bill is fiscally neutral, at least does not require referral to Ways and Means Committee, and that any fiscal impact can be accommodated within the budget that's already been approved for the Legislative Council Committee. However, it earlier did have a subsequent referral by prior reference, so if we're prepared to move on this, our recommendation should also include a rescission of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there a motion on the amendments? Representative Bunn moves the amendments 2949-4 to the bill in question 2949, bearing the date 4-2387. Further discussion on those amendments proposed by Representative Schoon and Legislative Council? Any objection to those amendments? If not, they're adopted.
Okay, on the bill as amended, Representative Hanlon?
Move it with due pass.
Thank you. Representative Hanlon moves House Bill 2949 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the full committee, and further moves that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee be rescinded. Further discussion on that motion? Okay, if not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bond?
Aye.
Dix?
Aye.
Allen?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Aye. Motion's adopted. Okay, let's try 2297, related to duration of financing agreements. And I believe when this was last before us, it's my recollection that the Secretary of State's office and the PLF were hoping to agree on some amendments. Don't know if we have those before us. Council, can you help us out, or are we going to get somebody else? We're on House Bill 2297. Mr. Taylor, we got some amendments prepared?
I believe we do. Have they been passed out? I believe they were. Okay.
Dash 4, Mr. Taylor?
Yes, dash 4, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, yes. If you could review those with us, and if there are any folks who should be invited to participate in this discussion, either
yes, there are.
The State Bar?
Yes, Mr. Les Rawls, and I believe Mr. Bob Olson. I believe there's also someone here from the title insurance company, Mr. Chisholm. And there may be people here from the Secretary of State's office also.
Okay. Extend an invitation to any of those folks to come up to the witness table and go ahead and take a seat as we go ahead and work through those amendments. Can you review those amendments briefly?
Sure.
Or who is identified as the proponent of those amendments?
I believe it would be the Liability Insurance Fund, and I believe they have talked with the those who represent the title insurance companies about this issue. This relates to security interest and the following of security interest. And under current law, which was adopted in 1961 in the Uniform Commercial Code, which in turn was originates back in the middle 50s, 1950s, a security interest securing a underlying loan agreement is currently good for 5 years. And evidently there has been a problem both for practitioners who don't practice that often in the area and for small businessmen, the fact that they have been selling assets, taking back a security interest in those assets, and that will run either for 5 years or renegotiating that 5-year period to give the borrower a chance to work out his financial difficulties. And after doing so, the borrower gets into difficulty and the bankruptcy court steps in, and the person who sold the business is finding himself being wiped out. He's being treated as a general creditor. As a result, is losing his secured interest position and losing any money that he may have had coming to him from the sale of those assets. These amendments do one thing. What they do is, Mr. Chairman, is create a bifurcated system so that if the security interest is 5 years or less, then we would maintain the current system of a 5-year period for the filing statement with the right to file a continuation statement. If the underlying security interest is greater than 5 years or has the potential for being greater than 5 years, then we would allow for a 10-year filing period. In addition to the 10-year filing period, there would be a substantial increase in the filing fee to make up for any potential economic costs that may result from this. I think Mr. Rawls may have some additional comments concerning this. I also understand, Mr. Chairman, that this proposal is being looked at by the people who are, I think, the connected to the Uniform Commercial Code as a potential model for them, because, as I said, this was initiated back in the 1950s. And since that time, particularly in the last several years, we're finding that people are getting loans on assets other than real estate that are extending well beyond the five-year period.
Okay. Are there any questions regarding the amendments, or perhaps I should ask the folks at our witness table if they'd like to comment at this time? I assume you've had an opportunity to review the amendments. Are you prepared to indicate to us that you're all in favor of those amendments, or any additional comments for the record before we take any motions on those amendments?
Mr. Chairman, as a subcommittee, we have discussed this among the Secretary of State's office and Mr. Chisholm with the title insurance people, and we think that the amendments that are before you at the present time will satisfy the problem as we see it. The one question that the Secretary of State's office raised is the procedural effect on this, and